special. Well, old school hood nigga best and crest. I like moans when I kiss my girl.
We go from experimental, electronic, alternative pop music, R&B and hip hop, to some rock, EBM and dark wave. This is Pop Montreal. You've got music of every genre for everyone. I hope you like feedback, because this recording will have feedback. It's not our fault. DIY or die.
I can do something.
For news you need to know, listen to Off the Hour, weekdays from 5 to 6 p.m. From Montreal, across Canada, and around the world, we have it all. Hard-hitting reports, eyewitness interviews, and in-depth documentaries exploring the issues without the corporate spin doctoring.
You know, there are two ways to go through life. One is to believe everything. The other is to believe nothing. Both ways avoid thinking.
Catch the news on Off the Hour, weekdays from 5 to 6 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM.
It's just past 5 on Tuesday, September 19th. You're listening to Off the Hour, broadcast on CKUT at 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bugel. Today on the program, you'll hear stories I've been covering with the Local Journalism Initiative. A vigil on Monday calling for the search of a Manitoba landfill for the bodies of two Indigenous women. The Mohawk Mothers injunction request for the Royal Vic site here in Montreal. Coverage of the controversial Housing Bill 31. And how the housing crisis is hitting students at the start of the fall term. But first, here's what's making headlines this week. Last weekend, Montrealers took to the streets to demand change from the federal and provincial governments. On Sunday afternoon, members of the group Solidarity Across Borders rallied outside the office of Federal Immigration Minister Mark Miller to demand status for all. And Saturday saw hundreds of Montrealers in the streets protesting Bill 31. If passed, the bill would end tenants' right to transfer their lease. The Commission de l'Aménagement du Territoire started hearing comments on Bill 31 last Thursday. Those discussions continue on Wednesday and Thursday of this week. Here's Housing Minister Francilaine Duranceau at the start of Thursday's session.
Donc, je remercie mes collègues parlementaires qui sont ici aujourd'hui, ainsi que les participantes et participants qui auront l'occasion de contribuer aux consultations particulières du projet de loi 31 modifiant diverses dispositions législatives en matière d'habitation. Ce projet de loi, que j'ai eu le plaisir de déposer à l'Assemblée nationale en juin dernier, vise, entre autres, l'atteinte d'un équilibre entre trois grands principes: le droit au maintien dans les lieux, le droit de propriété et le fait que l'écosystème locatif est fondé sur une négociation entre les locataires et les propriétaires.
Later on the program, you'll hear from the bâtonnière of the Barreau de Québec, Catherine Claveau. She'll outline some of the proposed changes to representation at the Housing Tribunal, as well as the next steps for the bill at the National Assembly. This Wednesday at 6, the Association Coopérative d'Économie Familiale du Nord de Montréal, also known as ACEF du Nord, is putting on a town hall to discuss Quebec's energy transition and energy affordability. Here's ACEF du Nord's Isabelle Maillot-Baïque on why they're hosting it and what's on the agenda.
Well, we figured that this law was going to probably have impact on everything related to Hydro-Québec. The bill isn't out yet, so we don't exactly know what's going to be in it. But basically, our fear is that the government wants to do the energetic transition, and we are afraid that they might be using Hydro-Québec as a means to do that. We think that we have to do the transition, but we don't want it to be done through the Hydro-Québec. Well, for us, we would like the government to respect the first mission of Hydro-Québec, which was to provide low-cost electricity to all Quebecers. As times went by, slowly the government started to see financial opportunity in Hydro-Québec, and now Hydro-Québec gives 75% of their profit to the government, which is already a lot. And we think that this is a problem because it makes the electricity bill higher. And we would like that the electricity bill is only related to the service and not used as any other means for the government.
Again, that will take place this Wednesday at 6 p.m. with snacks starting at 5:30. To attend, visit 7595 Boulevard Saint-Laurent. This past Sunday was the second annual Defund the Police Festival held in Vinay Park. Now, the Defund the Police Coalition is hosting a panel discussion on the decriminalization of drugs from the point of view of community organizations and clinics. The event will be held this Thursday at 6 p.m. at Atwater Library. On Monday, the Front Commune began hosting strike assemblies after negotiations with the government stalled. The Common Front is an alliance of four major Quebec unions, representing over 400,000 workers in health, social services, and education. The province is offering public sector employees a 9% salary increase over 5 years, plus a lump sum of $1,000 for the first year of their contract. But unions say that just won't cut it amid rising inflation and a cost of living crisis. A positive mandate would allow the unions to trigger a general strike in the future. Assemblies will continue until October 13th. Members of the public are invited to a rally for the public service this Saturday, September 23rd at 1 o'clock in John Mons Park. On Monday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made international headlines when he said the Indian government of Narendra Modi was behind the murder of a Canadian Sikh leader. Hardeep Singh Nijjar was killed outside of Vancouver last June. He's been linked to the Khalistani movement, which advocates for Sikh separatism. Trudeau said the intel comes from Canada's intelligence services. The accusation follows a diplomatic visit between Trudeau and Modi and puts Canada-India relations into question. Local Montreal groups urged the government to go further in their condemnation of the Modi government, which has been under fire for exclusionary Hindu nationalism. In a statement released Tuesday, the South Asian Diaspora Action Collective and others called on Trudeau to stand up for the rights of religious minorities and oppressed communities in India. Here's a member of that collective speaking to CQUT at a protest this summer.
All over India, places of worship are being attacked. And so we want the Canadian government to be strong to stop people who are belonging to such an ideology to come to Canada. They should not be allowed to come here. And we want organizations which are fostering this hatred within North America to be controlled, there should be a crackdown on these groups which are spreading hatred.
On Wednesday, three opposition parties, as well as the Union étudiante du Québec and the Fédération étudiante collégiale du Québec, called on the province to pay public service interns. The National Assembly voted unanimously in favor of Pascal Bérubé's motion to pay public sector interns last March. But critics on youth and higher education from the Parti Québécois, Québec Solidaire, and Québec Liberals say student trainees are still in the dark on whether their internships will be paid.
Donc le gouvernement a dit oui à cette motion et nous attendions légitimement.
Bérubé, the Parti Québécois spokesperson on higher education, says the government said yes to this motion and we legitimately expected for the start of the school year an announcement, something new, a real recognition. That hasn't happened yet. When questioned, Bérubé said they were in favor of all internships being paid, though that falls outside the confines of his motion. He also said it was an equity issue.
La motion portait sur le secteur public, vous avez raison, parce que c'était davantage notre champ d'intervention, mais on comprend tout à fait et on est en faveur que chaque stage doit être rémunéré. Certains le sont présentement dans le privé, d'autres le sont pas du tout. C'est une question d'équité aussi.
Madwa Nikakade, the Liberal spokesperson for youth and employment, said that as the province experiences a labor shortage, paying interns for public sector work makes good business sense.
And it seems to us that there's something that doesn't make any sense, that we don't give a fair compensation to mostly these women, but young people. What we do when we don't compensate them, we push them away from these programs. We create a situation where the labor shortage is even more important in the public sector in particular, where the population needs services.
As of press time, no announcement from the provincial government has been made.
Pop Montreal, Rewind, Forward, and CKUT present a night of Jamaican reggae and electronic music in the basement of the Rialto Theater. Don't miss Lila Ike with Gazeborg, Alana Stewart, and Ground Sound. Saturday, September 30th, 2023, at the Piccolo Rialto. Tickets on sale now. Visit popmontreal.com for more details.
Around 100 people gathered in downtown Place du Canada on Monday night in solidarity with the families of two women believed to be buried in Winnipeg's Prairie Green landfill. Winnipeg police say that 39-year-old Morgan Harris and 26-year-old Mercedes Myron were murdered and their bodies left there by a local serial killer.
Yeah, there have been continuous demands for the landfill to be searched to identify the bodies of these women and to demand justice, demands which have been repeatedly shut down and refused by the Manitoba government, by the Winnipeg police. And this is, you know, despite efforts to support a search by the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, even like people are coming up forward and saying, I would volunteer in a search kind of thing. And so even in the face of all of this, the families are still being told that they will not have justice.
This is Laura August, coordinator of the Isque Project at the Native Women's Shelter, who helped organize Monday's vigil. She says the Manitoba government's refusal to recover the bodies is based on prejudice.
Their justification has been that it's not safe, it would be too prolonged. But, you know, like we have seen very prolonged and very cost prohibitive, like very expensive searches happen for other people's bodies who were not Indigenous. So these types of searches have taken place, but really it's because these women are Indigenous that the government feels like it's okay to make this justification.
A feasibility study estimated that a search could take up to 3 years and cost up to $184 million. Native Women's Shelter Director Nakuset said that if Manitoba is serious about reconciliation, they would try any way they could.
Think if it was your daughter or your family member or a cousin that was in this landfill, that was suspected in this landfill. It is so hard for us when our family members go missing. There are four families that suspect that their loved ones are in this landfill. Why would you say no? If we're offering to get the expertise to help through this, why would you say no?
A small group of family members and allies have been camped outside the landfill since last December. They say they still haven't seen action from any level of government, including Federal Crown Indigenous Relations Minister Gary Anandasangari.
And here I am standing in Montreal and Ottawa 10 months later, begging for the same thing, which is something as basic as a basic human burial, human dignity and respect for my mother, Morgan Harris, and Mercedes Myron. But why aren't all levels of government being held accountable for the lack of actions and change with the decision to not search the landfill, not only back in December, but the fact that we're still standing here today begging for that? Has set a precedent that if any of us, any Indigenous woman, man, girl, child goes missing, this provincial government of Manitoba and the federal government of Canada has told the rest of Canada and society that it is okay to continuously murder and dispose of Indigenous women and girls and two-spirited, and that's what they're worth. And we're supposed to be okay with that?
Cambria Harris said that government institutions had been harboring her mother, Morgan, long before the refusal to recover her body.
My mother was a victim of not only the child welfare system, but she had fallen victim to addiction and mental illness after having all of her children whipped away from her due to the child welfare system. My house was raided. At 6 years old, I returned from a sleepover at my Aunt Crystal's to return to my house surrounded by police and garbage bags. And they didn't even let me say goodbye to my mom. That was the start of it all, and that's the start of it for a lot, and a lot of Indigenous women across Canada, when their children are ripped away from them.
But she and other family members, including her mother's cousin Melissa Robinson, thank supporters for giving the issue national attention.
Just 4 weeks ago,
we, as a family, declared September 18th as an International Day of Action, search the landfills, just 4 weeks ago. Look at where we're standing now. We currently, as of today, had 22 cities standing with us in solidarity. Canada has spoken. They are saying, search these landfills. Our women are not trash. No human is trash. But in the government's eyes, in the Canadian government's eyes, we seem to be.
The message at Monday's vigil was clear. Search the landfills and don't take no for an answer. Here's Mohawk activist Ellen Gabriel.
In the UN Declaration of Human Rights, it talks about barbarous acts. It talks about genocide. And the fact that the Premier of Manitoba refuses to respect the dignity of Indigenous women who have been murdered is a barbarous act. And when we think about our murdered and missing Indigenous sisters and men, we need to really do them justice by actually pushing for major changes. I was told there's an election next month in Manitoba. Kick her out. Yeah. Kick her out.
Manitoba heads to the polls on October 3rd. In the meantime, these families won't stop fighting. I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening. That protest comes mere days after the Mohawk mothers sought an emergency injunction in Quebec Superior Court against drilling and excavation at the Royal Victoria Hospital site. Here's Nakuset again on the link between the two cases.
Well, I mean, the common denominator is that we aren't able to do the work, that we feel like there's something that needs to be done, and it's not happening.
As of press time, a decision from Thursday's hearing hasn't yet been reached. Here's our coverage on that story from last week. The Mohawk mothers have filed an emergency motion to halt drilling and excavation at the Royal Victoria Hospital site. The group fought to have the Royal Vic redevelopment include an archaeological search for human remains, based on a local account that Indigenous children had been taken to the site for medical experiments. McGill and the SQI, or Quebec Infrastructure Society, have to include the Mohawk mothers in this process. But at a press conference outside the site today, the group said information has been withheld.
It's an Indigenous-led investigation, but they're taking control of all of the information that comes from this.
Yesterday, McGill Provost Christopher Manfredi announced that a new phase of construction would begin. He wrote that in the 10 sites where detection dogs and GPR, or ground-penetrating radar, had highlighted possible remains, nothing was unearthed through investigation. Today, he sent another update stating, McGill takes the view that the work has been conducted in full compliance with the panel's recommendations and with the settlement agreement reached last April. But a representative from the Mohawk Mothers says this process has been rushed and the panel Manfredi mentions has been disbanded, so they can't assess the findings.
When they did the GPR, there were several, and only a few were looked into, and they were rushed.
This comes less than 2 months after members of the group were harassed by security personnel outside the Royal Vic. They say they still see members of that same security firm at the site.
And then now we're here and we're still seeing some of the people that work for the commissionaires who are actually the main culprits within this attack on us. They're still working here.
Here's my interview from earlier today with one of the Mohawk mothers about her own experience and why it's important for the group to be truly included in the process.
Do you mind introducing yourself and just telling me your part in this campaign?
I am Gahandineta of the Bear Clan. I live in Ganawage, and I was once a McGill student a long time ago. But I have been involved with the situation here for 2 years now. We started And now we've got it to this point where we're looking for our children. We want to find them. They mean so much to us. And it was during my lifetime that those children were taken away.
So tell me about the campaign. How did that start? What was it about the history of the Royal Victoria Hospital that made your group, you know, feel the need to get involved in this way?
Well, we knew about it. We grew up knowing about it. At least, you know, my age, we knew that children were disappearing, and they even tried to get some of my brothers, my brother and his sister. They were coming to the reserve and giving these IQ tests, and the ones that did very well on the IQ test, they said there's something wrong with them, and so they brought them up here. And I ended up fighting to stop that. I was very young at the time. So I knew at that time that there were these things. And then we knew about it from our grandparents, who talked about what had happened, that we had lost children, and that they were declared as orphans and they were taken away. And newborn babies were taken from us, you know, right from the Royal Victoria Hospital. When the baby is born, they take the baby because the woman is not married. And so they just sign it away. Somebody comes in there. It's usually from the Salvation Army. And at least in my case, it was. And they tried to take my baby, brand new baby. And I was still coming out of the fog of delivery. And I asked her, "Who are you?" And she said, "Oh, it's for the baby. You just have to sign this." I said, "Well, who are you? What for?" "Oh, we have a very nice family for this baby." And anyway, I won't tell you what I did. But I woke up from my stupor, and I was so scared, for one thing. I had to do something. My baby was right there next to me. And she had just been born. Anyway, that's all I want to say about that. It was a horrible experience. But I have seen those experiences before. So I suddenly realized it was happening to me. So I'm very old now, and I remember those things. I remember what I was told about it.
So tell me about the campaign now and the supervision that your group, the Mohawk Mothers, have been doing to the construction and the redevelopment of the Royal Victoria Hospital site. What has been happening over the last few months, and I guess how has that differed from the original agreement that you had with McGill and the SQI, the Société Québécoise d'Infrastructure?
Well, it goes right back to October 2022. When we got the agreement to stop everything until we find our children. And we did a ceremony here. And because the children want us, we feel them, we sense them, they are here. And so we had this condolence on the side of the mountain. And we had a feast for them. And we said, "Help us to find you. You'd guide us." And they are guiding us. There are certain professional ways that they're supposed to look at whatever is found, and that's not being done. For the most part, it's not. You know, for example, they dug up 9 anomalies there that were found by these people from British Columbia, and it was done so fast, and they dug right in there, and they, you know, with one of those diggers, and they were in such a hurry to get through that because they had planned to start putting up this building. They are very, very anxious to get that started. So they went ahead and did it, but they didn't complete the work because it's supposed to go to archaeologists who are trained in just that kind of work to look at that. And they're the experts, and, you know, what they did was they disbanded the experts, and so they couldn't look at anything. And there were things like that were constant. Every time we turned around, there was something that was being done to us. It just showed so much disrespect for us and for our feelings and for what we're doing. And we don't want any money out of this. We haven't asked for any money. We just said we want to find our children.
Open the door. Seek new world. In here, Security 90.3 FM from Montreal.
Join the Free Kick Radio Show on Sunday, September 24th for a live broadcast from the Argenson Park Softball League Finals from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on the air at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
What happens now?
We get a free kick.
Step outside the CKUT office and it becomes clear. University students are back in town for the fall term. They're finding their footing in new classes, new clubs, and often a new apartment. But how is the housing crisis hitting students? Here's what folks at McGill's Y Intersection had to say when asked about finding housing for the fall term.
Hi, I'm Iman. I'm a psych major here at McGill. It's my first year. I did consider living here on campus, but I think it's very expensive. And I decided to with the tuition fees and everything, to just stay at home and be able to just pay for school and pay for books. I think I'm most likely going to stay with my friends for as much time as I can.
So my name is Kashish. I'm also a first-year student at McGill. It's our first semester. My major is also psychology. And honestly, as for housing, I'm not really sure because I also live in the South Shore with my parents and I didn't really give it much thought. Yeah, with transportation and everything, sometimes I do feel like if only I was living closer, then I wouldn't have to spend an hour. I mean, an hour is not bad, but it still gets really hectic. But I don't really have much of a stable income to think about housing at the moment. And my parents do a lot for me, so I don't want to put more things on their plate.
Yeah, hi, I'm Ryan. I'm in my U3 year studying geography and poli-sci. This is definitely a stressful time trying to find different places around Montreal, especially because places can be really expensive. And I was really fortunate to find a place in the Milton Park area. But I know from speaking to my friends, trying to move places even is such a hassle. And it's so challenging to especially find a really good place for a good price around the Montreal area.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I'm a fourth year student at McGill. So I live with three roommates, so I did find it. We were looking for an apartment starting last winter, so we were finding it a bit challenging for a place that was good quality and not too expensive and in the area we wanted with enough bedrooms, and we did find one that has one bedroom with no windows. I find that to always be the case, one bedroom is just not up to standard.
Over at Concordia, Leanne Ashworth says many students are in dire straits with not enough housing to meet the high demand. Ashworth is the manager of the Concordia Student Union's Off-Campus Housing and Job Resource Center, also known as HOJO. Here's our conversation. Right now we're hearing that Montreal is in the midst of a housing crisis. At HOJO, you are there to support students who have, some difficulties in their off-campus housing. What kind of stories are you hearing from students at the start of the fall term?
Well, we're hearing about students who are struggling to even communicate with a landlord. Basically, a lot of students are searching online. That's now the new norm, definitely in Montreal. And they're not getting any calls back. And I think the reason for that is there's such a high demand for apartments right now as the semester starts that Usually within an hour of an ad being posted, it's taken. So we're encouraging students to look at the ads that have been posted in the last 30 minutes and really try to focus on those. And if they can, set alerts and check multiple times a day. But just even to get a response, never mind to actually get a viewing or even be able to hand in an application form, now there are like a lot of steps that students aren't even getting to.
In terms of, yeah, these new steps, I've been hearing that before you just need a reference from a past landlord, credit check, that kind of a thing. Now it seems like multiple pay stubs, employer references, sometimes even ID, social insurance number, all these things are being requested more regularly, even at times a security deposit. What are you hearing in terms of just, yeah, the kind of demands being placed on them in order to find and secure housing?
I mean, we've seen excessive demands for private information and financial information in the past, but I guess as the competition really heats up for the apartments, landlords really have the power in terms of getting excessive information from students. So they're getting information about students, they're getting information about their families, financial situation, and personal identification information. So in a lot of cases, students don't have a regular job that would allow them to, you know, clearly show that they could pay the rent each month based on the high rents that are, you know, increasingly covering Montreal. And so they'll have their parents or another family member sign on as a co-signer. And so the co-signers are also being asked to fill out application forms with everything from birth certificates, banking information, driver's license information. If they own a home, they may be sending information about the valuation of their home. All kinds of information, the kind of stuff you really don't want to get into the wrong hands because fraud is increasingly a problem.
You know, this is what I'm hearing is that things that existed in the past are just getting more and more prevalent each year. What's the difference between this year and previous ones, you know, in terms of how many students you're seeing who are affected by the housing crisis or just even like still haven't found housing over a week, almost 2 weeks into the fall term?
Yeah, like I was saying, there is more and more students looking for housing before the semester starts, before they arrive in Canada. So a lot of international students looking online. And I think because of the knowledge out there that there is a housing crisis, a lot of different actors are posting false ads online and students are sending money online to people that don't even have apartments to rent and are untraceable. They're sending money through untraceable methods, which is really challenging for them because they're often out money by the time they even arrive here. We also have students coming who had no idea there was a housing crisis. They thought the university would take care of them or that there would be some easy housing if they just increase their budget. But the thing is, with this crisis, there's not enough housing, period. So there's just literally not enough places for people to stay. So no amount of money can really increase that. That's what we're seeing. So people will say, okay, well, I can just increase my budget $500. I'll pay multiple months up front. And still, they're not even getting responses. We're seeing students trying to improvise. We're seeing people renting out their living rooms to their friends. Ads for hallway spaces being rented out in apartments. People are really just trying to find places to sleep and are really desperate. And also, I think people are struggling with high rents and are trying to fit more people in apartments, which could cause greater issues down the line.
What do you normally do if somebody, you know, doesn't have a place to stay? I know McGill has 4 emergency rooms reserved for students who are having these kinds of housing difficulties. Yeah, what I guess is available at Concordia or in the community for folks who don't have the option to ask a friend to give them, you know, their couch for the month?
This was something we really started seeing last year and that precarity we were getting really concerned by. And actually, we started a pilot project, which is a transitional housing project. And right now we do have a few units that we are able to house students in on a short-term basis. We have a program to help them find housing and if they need part-time work in order to afford the rents that are out there. So that's something that's in the pilot stage. We're really excited about it. It's something we really need because the other option is what, homeless shelters? And that's a huge jump for a student coming to university to end up in a homeless shelter. So I don't think anyone wants to see that.
taking sort of a step back, students in general, and especially international students, are getting kind of a bad rap for rising rents, the affordability crisis. What would you like listeners to know, I guess, about the experiences of the students that you talk to?
Good question. There's a large number of students coming from out of province and internationally, and they have been vetted by the government, and they are a huge part of our economy, and they're like a huge asset in terms of the brain power and the knowledge that they're bringing and gaining at university. And it's becoming near impossible for them. They pay usually $20,000 just to come to school here, just, you know, on a per year basis, plus the cost they're paying for housing. And they've done so much work to get here, and yet they can't have the same rights as other people who are living and studying and renting here. And it's really like a double standard. That's not what people were sold as, you know, you come and pay this really high tuition, but you're going to have a good experience, you know, being discriminated against in terms of housing or having an impossible time finding housing is extremely stressful. And they're kind of between a rock and a hard place at the time that they're already here, right? Or they're already admitted and they've committed. So for these students, it's just something they have to try to work through, but it's extremely challenging and it's hard for them to understand why this is happening. You know, they're willing to live, you know, multiple people in a small apartment. They're willing to pay more. They're willing to give private information, and still they can't get a break. So I think it's like really hard for people who've maybe never spoken with or met people that are really trying to get established in Canada, but like people are going through a huge amount of stress and there's no easy solution right now.
On the other hand, if students who are new to the province, new to the city, want to get more involved, want to know their rights, what would you suggest? You know, it's hard to extricate yourself from this kind of cycle of rising rents, but if people want to take a more active role, what would you recommend?
Well, we do have really good rental protections here in Quebec. And the thing is, we also have a history of agitating for good protections. And so students can be part of that, no matter where they're from, no matter how old they are, how much experience they have in the rental market. Learning about these things and how you can take action, how you can encourage and support your friends in taking action is a really good idea. So things that we have in Quebec that we're really lucky to have are rent control. And this is something that is in Section G of your lease. The landlord can only raise the rent a certain amount. If there is something going on there that is excessive, you can file and have the government take a look at that. And we help students do that. Housing committees, there's one in each neighborhood. They also will help students. They'll help anyone with information on how to file for a rent fixation. Each year, the landlord is allowed to request a rental increase. There are guidelines for that, specific amounts. There's not one percentage, and students should inform themselves. This is something students are good at, is doing their homework. And this is information you can learn. And again, students can come see us. We have information online as well as workshops we give. And also housing committees give information on this. So those are really good things to do in terms of rent control. For students who are leaving for the summer, subletting their apartment, there are ways you can do this in order to hold on to your lease. Right now, we still have the right to lease transfer. So for students who are looking to move out of their apartment, you can transfer that lease to another student, and you should, because we need the rents to stay under control. So this is another method of rent control. So there's a lot of things students can do just by learning more about how things work here and even reading your lease front and back. That's a good start just to get a sense of what is going on with that document. So those are a few suggestions that come to mind.
That was Leanne Ashworth of the Concordia Student Union's off-campus Housing and Job Resource Center. It's not only the folks at Hojo who are seeing more and more competition to find housing. Jeffrey Carter says he and his girlfriend have rented out extra rooms in their apartment for the past 7 or 8 years. During the pandemic, they moved into a condo, but kept subletting their old 3.5 and netting the profit.
So I'm a pseudo landlord. I sublease out an apartment that I used to live in. When I moved out, the concierge said that I could keep on renting out to roommates or subleasing to roommates since I would be moving out. It worked for the landlord doesn't care as long as the money comes in and no one's making a disaster. The concierge doesn't have to find anybody. And I pocket some extra cash at the end of that. So I've been doing that for the last couple of years.
Carter says the price per room hasn't changed in that time, but the response has. Now, when he posts an empty room, he gets hundreds of messages within days.
The ease of which and the number of people that contact me to rent a room just has exploded, especially in the last 2 years in comparison to the almost decade ago when we first started renting out the place. It used to take us days, maybe even weeks to find someone. We used to put the ad up maybe a month before someone was going to, one of our roommates was going to move out. And now we could put it up the day of and someone would come to us within an hour, I'm sure.
With a response like that, Carter could raise the rent easily, but he says it's not in the cards.
I guess I have the philosophy, just because I can doesn't mean I should. You know, maybe I remember enough 10 years ago or so when me and my girlfriend, we were broke as hell and going to food banks. Like, we were flat broke in that position that you didn't get the check for the rent? Oh, okay, it must have gotten lost somewhere. I'll write one again in the next few days. I think we both empathize with that situation that someone can be in. And I guess I just feel... I mean, I'm still making money off of it. I'm still pocketing $500 to $600 a month. Like, it's good enough, the profit that we make, and it pays for itself.
Come back to tough on tour. I'm having flashbacks of us, no clothes with the sex and the weed combo. I need to see you, girl, pronto. Come back to Toronto. I'm having flashbacks of us, no clothes with the sex and the weed combo.
Bonjour, Montreal, what's going on? It's the R&B Trailblazer K-Force, and I'm just letting you know you can listen to my new song, Thug Passion, from my brand new album, Pray for a Beautiful Sky, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM, and you can go get that on Spotify, Apple Music, and Tidal, man. Let's go, Fway out, baby.
Across the province, protesters came out by the hundreds on Saturday to oppose the CAC's Bill 31. That bill is currently receiving comments at the National Assembly. Much of the public attention has been on the threat to lease transfers in the bill, and for good reason. Lease transfers help keep rents in Montreal affordable. Doing away with them during a housing crisis was bound to be met with pushback. Here's what protesters had to say at an earlier demonstration against the bill in Montreal.
You know, it almost feels like a joke at times, the way that the housing minister has completely disregarded the less than wealthy in this province and in Montreal. We're looking at a very dire situation for people who cannot afford expensive rent, which is honestly the majority of Quebecers. So it's completely, you know, just a complete disconnection from the reality of tenants in Quebec.
Well, lease transfer at this point, one of the few tools we have to guarantee affordability in rent. So rent, market rate rents are extremely high for a community with high immigrant and low-income population of Park X. The market rate is just too high. It's no longer affordable. So lease transfers are a way to assure that if someone's paying a low rent, they can transfer that onto someone who's coming in.
At our firm, we get calls every day, way more than we can handle as far as clients looking for someone to represent them. All the time they're being served insane rent increases or notices of rent evictions that there's going to be huge renovations so that they have to get out. Landlords really making it hard for people to live in places that they've been in for sometimes, you know, multiple decades. And because they have low rents, landlords will do anything to get them out.
But there are other elements of the bill that deserve scrutiny, too. At an anti-rent eviction barbecue in Verdun, Lynn O'Donnell of the Comité d'Action des Citoyennes et Citoyens de Verdun told me the group is worried about changes to social housing in the bill.
The devil is in the details with this bill. They are with Bill 31 opening up subsidies to the private sector. They've completely cut Accès Logis, which was the only program in Quebec dedicated to social housing, replacing it with a program called the FAC that has abordable in the name, affordable. It's new, and no one quite knows exactly how it's going to work. I'm not sure they know. But what we do know is that subsidies will be open to the private sector. And that's the reasoning, right? They were like, we need to build more housing. But we don't want to be Toronto. We're going to have a bunch of luxury homes. I mean, they're not really luxury homes. They're just regular apartments, but they're at luxury prices. And that's what we'll see with this. We know that. And here at the CICV, I mean, we want the socialization of housing. We want the mass socialization of housing. And this program, the FAC, is not going to give us that.
On the other hand, there are parts of the bill that have received praise. If passed, Bill 31 will make it so that anyone you choose can represent you at the housing tribunal. It's a move that lawyers in the province approve of, but they say the bill still needs tweaks to make sure that tenants don't get taken advantage of. Here's Catherine Claveau, bâtonnière of the Barreau de Québec, on the proposed changes to representation and what more they'd like to see done. Just to note that that conversation is in French. An English version of the interview will go up on our website later this week. Now, here's Catherine Claveau.
Alors, nous, au Barreau du Québec, nous avons demandé aux avocats qui sont experts en droit du logement de nous recommander des commentaires à faire sur ce projet de loi dans l'optique plus protection du public et accès à la justice. Dans la loi actuelle, lorsque une personne physique, donc monsieur, madame, tout le monde, se présente devant le tribunal, il peut être représenté par son conjoint ou un avocat. Si par contre il y avait une impossibilité en raison de maladie, d'éloignement ou de toute autre cause jugée suffisante par un membre du tribunal, peut aussi être représenté par un parent, un allié ou un ami. Alors, il y avait quand même à faire une demande spéciale au tribunal. Ce que le projet de loi propose à l'article 29, c'est d'élargir le recours à des représentants potentiels en prévoyant, dans le fond, que toute partie aura le choix d'être représentée par un mandataire, ce qui élimine en même temps la nécessité d'avoir une justification pour faire appel à une tierce personne. La seule restriction qui est proposée, c'est que le professionnel ne soit pas, si c'est un professionnel, qui ne soit pas radié de son nom professionnel, déclaré inhabile à exercer sa profession, ou dont le droit d'exercer des activités professionnelles a été limité ou suspendu. Alors voici ce que nous, au Barreau du Québec, on a émis comme commentaire par rapport à cette nouveauté-là. D'abord, on appuie l'élargissement de la liste des représentants disponibles et l'élimination de la nécessité de la justification. Donc c'est plus simple, on est d'accord avec ça. Toutefois, nous considérons que le projet de loi devrait prévoir que tout mandat autre que celui conclu avec un avocat ou un professionnel, devrait être gratuit. Donc, si c'est un autre mandataire qui accompagne le justiciable ou la petite compagnie, il faudrait que ce soit gratuit pour éviter qu'il y ait des abus, que des charlatans, par exemple, s'ouvrent une carrière de représentant de personnes physiques, parfois vulnérables, en disant « Donnez-moi, par exemple, 500 $ et je vais aller vous représenter sans aucune garantie de qualité. » Donc, ce qu'on veut pour éviter ces abus-là, et c'est ce qui a d'ailleurs été fait en immigration, c'est pour éviter que ce soit n'importe qui fasse ça sur le dos de la personne qui avait un véritable besoin. C'est de le faire gratuitement. Donc, c'est vraiment pour accompagner la personne, l'aider de façon gratuite. Si on ne limite pas ça à des mandats gratuits, bien, on craint que des gens donc peu scrupuleux et sans expérience puissent abuser des locataires qui sont parfois vulnérables en leur promettant des résultats qu'ils ne peuvent pas garantir tout en leur exigeant le paiement des frais exorbitants. On a un exemple en droit d'immigration, par exemple. Il y a eu un manque d'encadrement à l'époque, là, en droit d'immigration. C'était ouvert à plusieurs hauts mandataires. Et ce manque d'encadrement-là a mené à des abus ce qui a forcé le gouvernement à adopter un règlement qui encadre les consultants afin de les prévenir. Alors nous, c'est ça, ce qu'on propose, c'est effectivement ce qui pourrait être utile en matière de logement, c'est que des organismes sans but lucratif voués à la défense ou aux intérêts des locataires, comme les comités de logement, qui ont développé vraiment une expertise pour accompagner le justiciable, pourraient offrir gratuitement des services de représentation devant le tribunal administratif du logement, ce qui n'est pas le cas actuellement. Effectivement, on propose d'élargir ça également.
Quebec Premier François Legault made headlines last week when he announced that Bill 31, in its final form, may not end lease transfers after all. He wasn't confirming, but leaving the door open to major changes in that piece of legislation. So I asked Catherine Claveau exactly what was in store for this bill, what we can expect to see happen in the next steps at the National Assembly before it gets passed into law. Here's what she said.
Au moment où on se parle, le projet de loi est à l'étape des consultations particulières où des groupes invités peuvent comparaître devant la commission parlementaire. Donc, après avoir entendu tous ces commentaires-là, la commission va produire un rapport qui va être déposé lors d'une séance de l'Assemblée nationale et il va y avoir un vote sur l'adoption du principe par la suite. Après le vote, le projet de loi est renvoyé en commission parlementaire pour l'étude détaillée, c'est-à-dire article par article, les dispositions du projet de loi. Donc là, c'est vraiment une étude détaillée. Et là, c'est à ce moment-là qu'il peut y avoir des amendements qui sont proposés au projet de base, qui donc, ça c'est dans le fond l'utilité des consultations, c'est lorsqu'on propose des amendements, qu'on y réfléchit, qu'on considère que le ministre responsable est en accord avec ça, bien, il y a un débat. Puis il peut y avoir aussi des oppositions. Donc, c'est à ce moment-là qu'il y a un débat là-dessus. Quand l'étude détaillée est complétée, le projet de loi revient à une séance de l'Assemblée nationale où, là, il fait l'objet d'une adoption, donc le vote final. Une fois que ça c'est fait, on s'en envoie ça au lieutenant-gouverneur qui sanctionne le projet de loi par sanction royale. Ça, c'est vraiment une formalité. Le projet de loi entre en vigueur le jour de sa sanction ou à une date prévue par le projet de loi.
In the meantime, Montrealers will keep fighting against that bill. One part of that fight is a possible rent strike organized by the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union. Here's a story on that from earlier this summer. This past Saturday, August 19th, Montrealers gathered at Parc La Fontaine with members of the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union. The union works to help organize Montreal tenants against illegal rent hikes, rent evictions, and mistreatment from landlords. Now, they're trying to get 5,000 Montrealers to join a rent strike in protest of rising rents and the proposed Bill 31. I talked to Sarah Taves about what a rent strike is and what's at stake.
So first of all, a rent strike is a process of tenants withholding rent until their demands are met, so the rent does get paid back and you don't get evicted. This is coming in response to Bill 31, which would give landlords the power to unilaterally refuse lease transfers, which right now are used as a method of keeping housing affordable by circulating it between a community, between roommates, before a landlord can step into increase the rent. So if Bill 31 is passed, we can expect to see an acceleration of the housing crisis in homelessness, like we've already seen through the pandemic.
There's a few different provisions in Bill 31, but it's the ability of landlords to refuse a lease transfer that's drawn the most concern. Lease transfers are a key part of Quebec's soft touch approach to keeping rents low. When it comes to rent increases, the province encourages negotiation between landlords and tenants instead of strict rent controls. Taking over an existing lease puts tenants on more equal footing in those talks. Landlords have long been able to refuse lease transfers if a prospective tenant didn't pass a credit or a reference check. But if Bill 31 passes, they won't need a reason. Taves says that this would effectively kill the practice.
What landlord is going to accept a lease transfer when they can refuse it and increase the rent as much as they want? Technically, if this bill is passed, a landlord will have to indicate the former tenant's rent on the lease, but they can invent any number. There's no way of verifying this. So it'll be very easy for rents to skyrocket in Montreal, as we're already seeing.
That's why the union is turning to a rent strike, and a big one, too. They say they're inspired by the gains that similar strikes have won over the years, and think the time is right for Montreal's own.
In 2020, in the U.S., a landlord association estimated that 30% of tenants were on rent strike. We're also very inspired by rent strikes in Toronto. In 2017, in Parkdale, tenants got some major wins, like a rent reduction program and maintenance that had long been neglected through a rent strike. We're also drawing on more historical precedents, like in 1963 in Harlem, tenants had rent reduced to $1 a month through a rent strike. So we're seeing these major wins that we could never obtain by going to the tribunal, and big collective wins as well. That's the other issue with trying to solve these problems legally, is that often we might get a win for ourselves, but our neighbors don't feel that.
This isn't the first time a rent strike has been tried in Montreal. There was a Canada-wide campaign during the early months of COVID-19, but that was organized in response to mass pandemic layoffs. When the federal government rolled out income supports, they took away the main motivator to strike. This time around, the strike won't start until there's strength in numbers, 5,000 tenants to be exact. That means the union is looking for Montrealers not just to participate in the strike, but to help spread the word.
Part of the goal with 5,000 tenants is that people take on the responsibility of organizing their neighbors as well, so that all the responsibility isn't on a few organizers in the Montreal Tenants Union. So we are really encouraging people to spread the strike with their neighbors.
Me alone, I'm probably not going to be able to do too much, but, you know, when you have the collective and trying to, you know, mobilize that collective power into some actions that could benefit the community, that makes more sense.
Speaking now is Clary Sanchez. He's lived in Montreal for 6 years, but just got involved with the union last month when he started having problems with his own landlord. Now he's organizing his neighbors with the rent strike, but he's getting mixed responses.
We see a lot of enthusiasm for it, but also a lot of fear, because not everybody can expose themselves like that. Even by defending my own interest, do I get in conflict with my landlord? And what happens if I have children or if I'm low income? You know, suddenly you have to negotiate all these things that intersect, you know. So I'm enthusiastic about it, but it's complicated because not everybody has the same degree of exposure to liabilities and stuff like that, especially when you are being frontal about defending your interests as a tenant.
If you're trying to organize your building, says Sanchez, it helps to build community first.
You know, you cannot force people to, even if it makes a lot of sense, to defend their own interests, but you just gotta kind of like show them what's possible to do as a community. I think the first step to advance into this kind of mobilizations to actually build a community, because you cannot really do ambitious things without having a community in the first place. If we build a community and I know them and they know me, they can see how this affects me. Maybe we can build some solidarity through that, rather than coming really hard, really dogmatic.
What's worked for him is starting things out on a lighter note.
A lot of people are already pretty stressed with their daily lives, so even though organizing can be a little bit stressful, if you're taking the lead in your building, just try to make it a little bit fun, just to make these ideas easier to digest and actually people showing off when you require some type of organization. So, for instance, I went not door knocking with my partner. We offer some cookies. We talk about what they do for a living, you know, what are their interests, and then through getting to know them, you know, you kind of get a better picture, and you know, you organize from time to time things like a picnic or like a cocktail night or something that to bring people together, so it doesn't become necessarily a meeting where you're gonna talk about the stressful things, which definitely is probably gonna happen, but you need to kind of like balance that.
But what about tenants' fears of reprisal? Tave says that while tenants should expect pushback from landlords, the union is working hard to avoid evictions.
Going on rent strike, for one, we have very strong legal protections in Quebec. At least for the first month of a strike, as long as the rent is paid back before a judge can make a decision, you can't be evicted. We are also imagining a significant strain on the court system, which is already clogged. With 5,000 tenants on strike, it's unimaginable that every landlord can get a court hearing. We are also planning to organize public responses to landlords filing for eviction to make it clear to landlords that they should wait out the strike instead of trying to evict their tenants. And we have lots of experience with this as a union of using pressure campaigns and collective power against landlords.
To learn more about the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union and their rent strike campaign, you can visit their link tree at slam.matu. It's just before 6 p.m., and you've been listening to our local journalism initiative roundup on Off the Hour. I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening.
This is Tony from Planet Giza, and you're listening to CKUT Montreal Community Radio. This is the crib right here, so shout-outs to every station on here, and shout-outs to you, the listener. Don't go nowhere. We'll be right back.
Would you be interested in switching your internet service providers to a provider that provides better service of internet service providing than your current provider? As we're
in the street. Radio stars are alive and well here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Thanks for listening. Pop Montreal International Music Festival is back for its 22nd edition from September 27th to October 1st, 2023. 5 days of music, film, art, panels, crafts, kids' activities, and more. Don't miss Candy Satin, Bonnie Prince Billy, Dr. Cornel West, Leith Ross, Jungle Pussy, Bahamadia, Shabazz Palaces, Tangerine Dream, Bell Orchestra, Lorraine James, Kate NV, Islands, Lila Aiki, Hand Habits, and many more. Tickets and discovery passes on sale at popmontreal.com.
Sego, wahni diyo gigo.
Tano gigo ne.